Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight, returning, is Alexander Lees. He's a senior lecturer in biodiversity at Manchester Metropolitan University, an associate of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And we're going to continue our conversation with a new book that he wrote with James Gilroy, Vagrancy in Birds. Alex, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book, but first, I want to talk to you about what I consider to be a really important paper that you were one of the authors of. It's in the Annual Review of Environment and Resources, and this past April it was published, April 23rd, 2022, and it's State of the World's Birds, and the scope of this paper is mind-boggling. Talk to me why you can do this with birds, but you probably are not as successful with other taxa.
Okay, thanks for having me back, Mark. So with birds, we simply know more about them than we do for any other sort of taxonomic group of organisms. You know, we've got an almost complete phylogenetic tree of all birds. We've got published data on traits of all birds. All birds basically have had their red list assessment, red list status assessed. And most of those species, that assessment has been completed. You know, there aren't many data-deficient bird species. We have a very good understanding of their taxonomy. So we know, you know, although the sort of total number of species is creeping up due somewhat sort of to do with taxonomic inflation and splitting, you know, we've got a pretty good handle on and how many types or kinds of birds there are, you know, within the remit of species versus sort of subspecies status, etc. So simply we have all these sort of data sets, and it's this sort of amazing understanding of where birds are in space and time that isn't reflected in many other groups of organisms.
Now, one of the organizations that's very important in assessing this data was the IUCN. Can you explain to the audience who they are?
Technically it's BirdLife International, who essentially runs the red listing process for the International Union for Nature Conservation. So the IUCN sort of maintains this red list of global conservation status of species globally, and BirdLife International, an ENGO based here in the UK, but with sort of satellite NGOs elsewhere in the world, sort of heads up that process for birds in the UK. So a lot of the co-authors of this paper I led were based at BirdLife, both sort of here in the UK and Cambridge, but also in South Africa.
I want to talk about some of the summary points in this paper. First of all, globally, there's been a deterioration in the conservation status of the majority of bird populations, including that of many formerly abundant species, especially at temperate latitudes. That's going to be surprising to a lot of people.
It is. Well, it surprised us in a way. So when we're sort of crunching through these numbers, essentially, you know, looking at the red list status of different species, I mean, essentially, there are more species in the tropics and more threatened species in the tropics. But actually, when you look at the proportion of species which are threatened, they're actually higher at temperate latitudes, which was counterintuitive. We didn't actually expect to look at that, and it seemed that no one else had really thought to do that either. And yes, we have, you know, very good data from temperate latitudes on trends in birds over time, so especially from North America and from Europe, but now also from India and a few other places as well. You know, we've been able to look at long-term trends in bird species, and indeed, you know, sort of 48% of taxa globally are showing evidence of declines, and this is often very...
So almost half the bird species are declining?
It seems, yes, that's the case, yeah. And only, you know, a relatively small proportion, you know, about 7% or so with positive sort of population trends, about 40% or so, which is stable, and about 7%, which we don't know, you know, one way or another.
Now, this surprised me too. I know, and I know the history of this. Most avian extinctions have occurred historically on islands, and most people know the story of this. You know, back in the exploration days, ships from Europe docked on these islands in the Pacific and the Atlantic. Rats came out, devoured a lot of the ground nesting species. People landed on islands and they sort of totally wiped them out. But today, a wave of extinctions appears to be impacting continentally distributed species. So that's new and very disturbing.
Yeah, indeed. So this sort of the major frontier for this is perhaps northeast Brazil. It's an area I've done some work historically as well, and that's where we've seen sort of three species quite recently declared as globally extinct. So rainforest species occurring in a biogeographic province where there's very little remaining rainforest cover, so highly, highly fragmented landscape, and, you know, which is now paying what ecologists sort of call an extinction debt. I mean, when these species were first discovered, which was only a couple of few decades ago, they were only then occurring in two or three rainforest patches, and now they're sort of winking out at these patches, and there are a load of other critically endangered species which look set to follow them to extinction unless there's sort of urgent sort of conservation interventions in these areas. And it's likely as well, and this is a paper that I wrote a few years ago with Stuart Pym, 2015, I think, is that there are probably other extinctions from these areas, but that they predate the history of ornithology in these areas, basically. You know, if there weren't people doing surveys there in the,
right.
in the anywhere before the sort of 1970s, it seemed quite likely that, that other, you know, endemic species could have been lost in these regions. And there is one little bit of evidence, for instance, from northeast Brazil. There's an old illustration from the 16th century of a curassow with a yellow bill, which, you know, there's no species which currently looks like that living in the area. So that would seem likely to have been an undescribed extinction. You know, there's no specimen. All we have is this old illustration, basically.
The problem in Brazil, it seems, and this is probably the problem in a lot of other countries, is a political one, too.
Yes, so Brazil and the Philippines and several other sort of tropical hyperdiversity places. So I spent most of my sort of adult life working in Brazil and sort of seeing deforestation rates fall all the way through to 2013, 2014, and now sort of seeing them rise again in situ. And then obviously there's potentially a chance of change in politics this year. But yes, I mean, globally, a lot of these challenges are tied to politics, and ultimately, you know, there is quite a lot we as individuals can do, but ultimately, it needs, you know, political leadership and acknowledging the sort of environmental problems we face.
The most points five, the most significant threats to avian biodiversity are habitat loss, fragmentation, and degradation, coupled with human over-exploitation and invasive alien species. So basically, humans are driving the extinction rate, just to state the obvious.
Yes. So, I mean, I can think of a few examples of what might have been sort of natural extinctions. There was, a subspecies of rock wren a few years ago, which was wiped out on an island in Mexico, and a volcano exploded, for instance, from regal habitat cover. But there's very little evidence of extinctions which were in some way, you know, sort of natural occurring. And we know that the background was sort of many times over the natural background rate of extinction. And it's worth bearing in mind then that sort of as conservation biologists, our job isn't necessarily to stop extinction happening at all. It's to make sure that the rate of evolution of new forms exceeds the extinction rate, and that's not happening. And the way in which extinctions are happening, it's often targeting, you know, whole unique branches of the evolutionary tree of life. That, you know, for forms to reemerge now would take, you know, many millions of years when you're sort of hammering entire branches of the tree of life.
And the elephant in the room, and this is brought up in the book on that we're also talking about, Vagrancy in Birds, is climate change. I mean, there's habitat loss, fragmentation, degradation, and then sort of the big umbrella problem seems to be climate change.
Indeed, and in climate change interacts synergistically with some of those other problems, degradation. So where I work in tropical forests, forest degradation results from fire and from selective logging. And when you have selective logging, that not only reduces the resilience of the forest, and then it can sort of wipe out niches for various species of specialists, but it also means that forest is more likely to burn because it's more open. There's more defecation, drying out of the leaf litter, and there's essentially dead trees lying around and dead material, fissile material. And then when we get sort of climate change on top of that, it means that the whole system is more stressed, it's drier, more likely to burn. And what we find is when we get El Nino years in the Amazon, you get prolonged dry seasons, And then these are the years when we tend to get lots and lots of fire activity. So all these different stresses can have impacts. And then talk about overexploitation, where you think about got a logging crew going into an area. It's not like they're popping into a supermarket or a 7-Eleven, whatever, to get their food, right? I mean, often, yeah, bushmeat is one of the few options they'll have. So again, you know, once you've got people entering into the forest, often extracting timber illegally, for instance, as most deforestation is in the Amazon Basin at present, then you're also getting bushmeat extraction, which just means loss of some of those large-bodied bird species like trumpeters and curassows, a bird I just mentioned earlier on too.
The frustrating thing for me reading the paper is this point. There's and this is a quote, a portfolio of conservation interventions is available to prevent bird extinctions, with considerable success already documented through evidence-based conservation actions. We know what needs to be done. We're not doing it.
Yes, by and large. And we're almost better, in a way, at stopping, you know, extinctions than we are preventing declines in more common species, right? I mean, when species end up getting towards the emergency room, if there is resources available, then these extinctions can be turned around. And I was a co-author on a paper last year, which looked at how many sort of species extinctions have been prevented in the last sort of 30 years. And there are lots of birds and mammals which have been saved from extinction. Yet, you know, there are lots of species moving on to the red list. There are lots of critically endangered species which we know very little about. Jumping to an example, sort of looking earlier in northeast Brazil, something like the Alagoas ant wren, you know, to save that species, probably we need to work out how to keep them alive in captivity and to get a captive breeding program underway. And well, I've got some colleagues actually sort of involved in some of this work in Brazil, but it's sort of starting from scratch. You know, we have no idea how to keep small sub-ocean, you know, South American insectivorous passerines alive, let alone in captivity, let alone breed them. So there's also, you know, the species we have saved often tends to be pigeons or hawks or game birds, things that we, you know how to sort of keep alive, whereas there's a whole big slice of the avian tree of life which have no knowledge of avian husbandry, for instance.
Under future issues, number 7, eradication of populations of invasive alien species can be spectacularly effective, but there are challenges in scaling them up to larger islands and continents. I spent some time on Lord Howe Island off the coast of Australia, where they had a problem with rats. They have a flightless rail there, the Lord Howe Island woodhen, excuse me. And they were, because of the rats, they were sort of restricted to the tops of these two small mountains on the island, but they have an ongoing rat trapping program, and now the wood hens have come down and they're now down in the lowlands. So that stuff does work. It's just doing it for scale on larger islands.
Yes, so a major challenge is, so it's the Royal Society of Protection of Birds has been, I think it's them that have been leading on a sort of project on Gough Island, where they've got all these introduced mice, which are sort of on their own evolutionary path, becoming a new species. They've sort of quadrupled in size, and they're eating albatross chicks alive. this is major rat eradication attempt there, or a mouse eradication attempt, has seemingly sort of hit problems there, because after dropping sort of millions of poison baits, you know, they've seen mice again. So, you know, doing this on a large sub-Antarctic island is difficult. Also, in New Zealand, they're sort of leading in the way on this, how to try and do continental systems. But again,
by transplanting,
a major challenge.
Well, like with the Kickapoo, they're like transporting these large flightless owl parrots, as they're called, to smaller islands where they can eradicate the rats and then raise them there.
Yes, yeah. So there's been a lot of that done, you know, sort of conservation translocation. But, I mean, I guess in long term, you know, you want these things back on the mainland, essentially, but it's whether you could ever do that, you know, whether you could ever eliminate, you know, rats from the mainland, possible with some of the larger the predators there potentially, and they're sort of traps that they're trying with stoats, such like at the moment. So, you know, it would be fantastic if that was possible.
Now, green energy transitions are essential to limit dangerous climate change, but, and this is happening around here, weirdly, they can have negative impacts on birds if inappropriately implemented. What we're finding out here in the Northeast, and it's probably happening in the rest of the United States, these sort of rank fields that had things like breeding grasshopper sparrow populations and other grassland birds are now being converted to solar fields, really fast, like before you knew what was going on. And that's not, I think that's starting to have a real negative impact on birds that would be found in those areas. And yeah, I don't think impacts research was done on any of these sites.
Sure. I mean, certainly it would have to be done here in this country. So there'd be quite a lot of environmental sort of licensing required to prove whether or not there would be any impact. But I mean, ultimately, it strikes me that, you know, there's the number of roofs available, I'm sure, both in North America and Europe, and roofs, you know, and spaces available, which wouldn't either impact fruit production or wildlife habitat. It just, I'm always dumbfounded, by the way, that we don't use all available roofs and infrastructure we already have and put solar panels.
No kidding. I mean, we could put them on parking garages here and all sorts of other downtown buildings, and they'd be incredible but for some reason, we're using up, it's all local deals, and it's sort of a complicated financial arrangement about how these.
Fundamentally, it's you know, sort of how can we make money doing this?
This is exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. Now, let me ask you, after working on a paper like this, are you at all feeling positive about the future?
Well, I mean, we try and highlight, you know, various case studies.
I'm asking for Alexander, I'm asking for an honest answer from your gut.
Well, I wouldn't say I was very positive, but okay. I think there's certainly room for hope. You know, it depends on politics. Now, what I'm least positive about is politics at the moment. You know,
no kidding.
You can get the politicians in.
Oh, my God.
Who can stand up for planet Earth. I think we can easily turn things around. I mean,
I know. You're absolutely right on that. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Mark Lynchman. My guest tonight is Alexander Lees. He's a senior lecturer in biodiversity at Manchester Metropolitan University and associate of Cornell Labs in ornithology. And we're talking about his new book, written with James Gilroy, Vagrancy in Birds. I want to get back to the Vagrancy book. When we were, I was one of the founding members of the Massachusetts Avian Records Committee, and we had to go back to the beginning of our records to try to vote, you know, was this a genuine record or not? And it seemed to me the most problematic group of birds to determine whether they were genuine vagrants or escapees was waterfowl. Waterfowl were like one enormous nightmare. How do you tell? People have, at least here, I don't know what it's like in Britain or the rest of the world, but one of the members of our committee who works at Fish and Wildlife brought in just a list of one person's waterfowl collection in the state, and it had every single species that we were considering for the list. Is that around the world the most problematic group of birds?
I think quite frequently, simply because, well, for two reasons. Because one, they're common in captivity, but two, they are likely very frequent vagrants. Because many species of waterfowl are highly migratory. Many species of waterfowl are also prone to abmigration, where they may share a breeding range or a wintering range with another species, and they might pair up with a member of the wrong species, follow a migration route, and end up, you know, somewhere else. They're also very good at crossing ocean basins as well, because, you know, they can physically sleep on the water. You know, so they've got the chance of survivorship for long oceanic crossings is quite high. We know there's lots of recoveries of ring birds moving between continents. Here we've even used stable isotopes to prove origins of species which are very controversial, like a Baikal teal in Denmark was shown to be a genuine vagrant because Baikal teal, a species like, you also get as a vagrant in North America.
Oh, yeah, and it's a beautiful bird, so it's in a lot of waterfowl collections.
Exactly, yeah. So it's in a lot of waterfowl collections, but it's also a species with a high vagrancy likelihood. So, yeah, you end up, and sort of I serve on the British Ornithologist Union Records Committee, and we've had to deal with various species which have sort of been left in limbo for a long time in the British list, things like falcated duck, which is recently accepted, Baikal teal, which is recently accepted, a white-headed duck, which we're currently dealing with, and marble teal as well. Both those latter species are from southern Europe, and which there probably isn't the sort of smoking gun vagrants or vagrant individuals we need. So hooded merganser is another good example in a European context, because, again, a very popular species and ornamental collections.
And it's, but I'll tell you, its population in northeastern North America and even here in Massachusetts is exploding.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
they're all over. They're probably next to mallards the most common breeding waterfowl in the state.
Yep. So it's another reason why, you know, given that the total number of the records was increasing, it seemed pretty obvious that there was a signal for genuine vagrancy there. So it ended up being picking an individual which was on on the west side of Scotland in an island group where the nearest landmass to the west was North America in autumn, etc. But then other people. Well, the problem with I guess our records committee in that sense is that you have a first record, everything else gets on. It's fine as long as there's nothing absolutely problematic about it. No obvious evidence of being an escape. It will just get into the totals. You know, if it was wearing a red plastic ring or whatever, or if it, you know, answered the name of Steve or something else, and obviously it's going nowhere. But it obviously meant that other people who had seen other records, which are not quite as good as that first one, you know, their records are rejected. So, you know, but we have to have a first record rather than just, you know, oh, we know there's a wild record. You know, we know there's a signal for vagrancy here, but we're not picking a single record. So, again, you can be very unpopular as a member of the record.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because I was just reading the recent British Birds, at least the recent issue that was sent to me, of May 2022, volume 115. And you have a great article in that. There was a record of the Patafield pipit in Britain. Now, this is found in Asia, and it's relatively sedentary, incredibly well documented by beautiful sketches, by the way, that were in that article, and photographs. But the identification was not the problem. It's the origin of the bird, of this vagrant. And what was interesting is, and I don't know if we only have statewide rarities committees here, but it went into Category D. Explain that, what Category D is.
So Category D is like a holding category, essentially. So it's Category A is for all the species except as natural post, like 1950. Category B is for everything that's only occurred prior to then. C is for like escapes, basically, and there's various subcategories. D is a category for species which we're not quite sure about that might occur in a genuine state, but, you know, there's no obvious first record, and it's sort of almost kind of like kicking the can down the road to wait for more information. So
and hope you die before the next record comes up because you don't want to deal with it.
Indeed. So white-headed duck, we mentioned earlier on, sort of sits on Category D, the various ducks on there. Things like saker falcon sits in there as well, a bird which we now know, you know, it might be an expected vagrant, but it's also extremely common.
Oh, yeah.
A falcon as bird, for instance. So with all these problem species, for instance, I think yellow-headed blackbird's on that list at the moment based on also as a potential vagrant, but the only records occurred at a time the species was widely in trade in Europe, for instance. So Patafield pipit ended up there. And again, it wasn't very popular because lots of people obviously went and twitched that bird. And it's kind of like we mentioned in the book, it's kind of like the reverse duck psychology there. Everyone expects pipits to be genuine, right? It's not like a duck. And it was somewhere really, really good for vagrant birds. At a time of year, really, really good for vagrant birds. And it was in a field with, you know, an American buff-belly pipit. You know, it was literally sharing a field with another, you know, really, you know, really, really, really rare bird.
But you want to err on the side of caution, obviously.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you know, if it had been like a red-collared dove or a chestnut-tailed starling or, you know, any number of other species which have a very low vagrancy likelihood, I doubt anyone would have even travelled or, you know, just would have written it off immediately. Because it was a pipit, people sort of think, well, you know, well, it's got to be a genuine vagrant, but it's still a resident tropical bird species, which is 7,000 kilometres out of range. And there were other odd things about it. It was a very poor plumage state.
That's right. There was a lot of weird feather wear on it.
Yeah, so it seems like that's not definitely a smoking gun, but it's a bit odd.
One of the things you were talking about before is that, you know, we used to have just ship assists. There's some records in your book of sheathbills from the Antarctica making their way incredibly further north. But nowadays, plane assist is a real possibility, is that a bird could get aboard a plane and get off where the plane gets off.
Yeah, so that's several records. I mean, maybe probably less than 10, perhaps, we know of. but presumably it has to happen more often.
Yeah.
There's an interesting record of a barn owl which was ringed, banded, if you like, in the UK and was then recovered in Afghanistan. Seemingly,
wow.
Presumably got on a military transport plane and was then transported, presumably alive, to Afghanistan. We know that there's been house sparrows have traveled all the way from Los Angeles to New Zealand, for instance. They've had a minor bird transported in a plane from, I think it's India to the UK, for instance. So a paddlefield, but a bit, you know, very, very common bird species on airfields. So it just struck us as a possibility. I mean, it's not a lot. We've got a lot of Christians. People said that was what the BRC said, that bird had got on a plane. That's just a possibility. But it just seems as remote as a bird being on a ship, as remote as a bird being a captive bird, because although some people say, well, no one keeps pipits, which is demonstrably untrue, because there's lots of records of this species in trade in Southeast Asia, but the bird didn't come from Southeast Asia because you've got the DNA. So we know it came from India, where there's a lot less evidence of trade, and it would have to be clandestine, so that's not very likely. But neither is it likely that a sedentary tropical bird would vagrate 7,000 kilometres.
Yeah, because, no.
You know, birds are quite predictable in what species do occur as vagrants, and it tends to be migrants, which, you know, either go the wrong way or fail to switch off that the zugenru, that migratory restlessness or whatever. And we don't randomly get all sorts of tropical bird species occurring out of range. It's just not something that happens. So, yeah, it's a mystery to us. You know, it would seem crazy to accept it straight off.
But you have you have category D. You can revisit that record.
We can, yeah.
Yeah, when there's more
indeed.
Evidence. But that doesn't satisfy hardcores. We're completely out of time because I don't want to even start about hardcores and records like this. My guest tonight has been Alexander Lees. He's a senior lecturer in biodiversity at Manchester Metropolitan University and associate of the Cornell Lab in Ornithology. We've been talking about first his monumental paper, which I think is very important, State of the World's Birds, in the Annual Review of Environment and Resources this past April. And then we've been also talking about his incredible new book, Vagrancy in Birds, written with James Gilroy. Alex, it's been a real pleasure.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.